Thank you very much, Tom, for your kind words and the nice introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here. I've been here once before, a few years ago, and remember it is a good occasion. The title, as you see, is Arbitrage Violation and Implied Valuation. This is a joint work with Yulia Yoffe. And as the title implies, we are going to speak about arbitrage violation in the option market and its connection to implied valuation. So first, let's see an overview of the talk. This is the points we're going to speak about. We're going to develop from first principle a necessary and sufficient condition for the satisfaction of the no-arbitrage condition in option market. We're going to completely be focusing on put and calls that are traded, in our case, on the S&P 500 index. There have been many papers in the literature about implied valuation, which I'm going to introduce in a minute. But a necessary condition to kind of move ahead and to speak about implied valuation is first to have set of observations that do not admit arbitrage, because the existence of a valuation operator is contingent on no arbitrage. So one would like first to make sure that the observation that we get about prices of put and calls are clean of arbitrage. There has been some work in the literature about that. We here develop something from a first principle. It's fairly simple and natural to use. We'll see that it induces a natural kind of discretization of the continuous state space, zero infinity, to some finite discretization, such that the no arbitrage condition is satisfied in the real market with an asset, an underlying asset, that could take any value in zero infinity, if and only if the no arbitrage condition is satisfied in some discrete economy where the state space is only finite. So that is the first kind of point. That immediately will induce a very simple and kind of offspring methodology that will be numerically efficient and very easy to implement to get a set of prices that are close as possible in some sense, in some norm, if you like, to the observed prices, such that this set of prices do satisfy the no-arbitrage condition in case your observations include noise and don't satisfy the no-arbitrage condition. Once this is done, and we kind of dub that process of cleaning the prices to get from observed prices that have arbitrage embedded in them to a set of prices with no arbitrage, we move to the second step. And we're going to introduce a new way of estimating a risk-neutral distribution, or equivalently something sometimes referred to as stochastic discount factor. And in the next slides, we'll introduce the notation. What is new in that case is that we're going to use the price function as a function of the exercise price of calls and put. That has been done in the literature before. It's well known that the price function as a function of the exercise price is a convex function. But for some reason, the literature, when estimating the risk-neutral distribution, did not take advantage of estimation of convex function, or no method for estimation of convex function, which we are going to take advantage of to estimate that convex function. And we'll see some details of the estimation. For example, we'll find out that it's going to be more efficient to estimate the put function rather than the call, as it's usually done in the literature, when you do it the way we advocate here. So the structure of the talk is going to be as follows. We are going to motivate what we are doing here and how it sits within the existing literature. That will also give us the opportunity to introduce our notation. We're going to then derive the no-arbitrage condition, highlight some economic interpretation of it, and then see how from that condition we get immediately this natural methodology of kind of eliminating the noise from the observed prices. Then we're going to move into the estimation via the convex function approximation, and we're going to conclude. Okay, so we all know that the absence of arbitrage in financial market is equivalent to the existence of a valuation operator, and that therefore gives the following result, that one can get the price of a financial asset. In our case, we are mostly interested in those contingent claims. So here S is the possible value of the underlying asset. Pay IS is the payoff function, which obviously depends on the value of the underlying asset. As I said before, we're going to speak only about the call and put and European. So this is the payoff at maturity, pay I of S for the asset I. And F of S is what is called the stochastic discount factor. And we know that the result of that integral is the no arbitrage price of a security which has the following payoff. So, for example, if you live in the Black-Scholes world, then this F of S is actually a scaling of the long normal distribution multiplied by the discount factor from time zero to time T, where the option matures. So now a relatively recent trend in the literature has been probably started nearly a decade ago, I would say, was rather than assume or get in some way the stochastic discount factor or the risk-neutral probability, look at the market, get the prices of securities that are traded in the market. We know that by the no arbitrage condition this is true. The payoff is known, the payoff function. So you have, let's say if you have capital I asset traded in the market, then you have that relationship, and rather than assuming the structure of F, you try to imply the structure of F to solve for F that will satisfy that equation. This is what is referred to in the literature, implied valuation, where F of S is the stochastic discount factor, equivalently sometimes referred to in the literature also as a valuation operator, because it allows you to value the prices of the securities. So that relationship obviously depends on the existence of no arbitrage in the market. But however, when you actually look in the market and you collect your observation, and we have some in the paper more elaborate empirical results, but I'm going to kind of highlight just a few. When you actually collect that, and obviously depends on the length of time that you look at, a minute, 10 minutes over a day, but mostly you find out that in most cases the no arbitrage condition is not satisfied due to noise and the fact that the option, you have a set of observations, not all traded exactly at the same instant, so you're actually aggregating together observation of prices at different time. Even, we'll see later on, even when we allow for the no arbitrage condition in the face of bid and ask prices, still we find out that in most cases it's not satisfied. So in order to derive the find the F here, and this relationship actually holds because of the Norbert flash condition, it will make no sense to try to estimate the F, and plugging in here are prices that admit arbitrage. So therefore, your first step will be to get the observation and clean them for arbitrage and get set of prices that do not admit arbitrage. So this is the second point here. And now the literature obviously has been aware of the fact that, that there's kind of some sort of inconsistency if you try to estimate the F, but you take observation that admit arbitrage. And there has been some attention to that point and some efforts to clean the prices from the noise in order to get prices that have no arbitrage. But the process in the literature, but for one paper that I'm going to mention later, that is fairly close to what we do here, but still miss one condition, and therefore end up at least at a certain level of checking only a sufficient condition, but not necessary. Most of the paper in the literature, they try to check various things, for example, the satisfaction of the put-call parity between certain couples, monotonicity, as we know from Merton's work about rational option pricing, the function should be monotone also as a function of the exercise price, for the case of the call, monotone decreasing, for the pot, monotone increasing. So some of that has been checked, but there was no systematic way and really easy way, as we'll see here, to actually look at the prices, find out immediately if they admit arbitrage, and if they do, then try to find a set of prices that are close as possible in a certain sense to those observations, and move ahead to the estimation of the implied valuation operator. So our first step is to clean the prices. Actually, I already covered the point here that the cleaning process, as I said, it's not done in a systematic way. There is a step-by-step examination of certain properties that we know have to be satisfied by prices that admit no arbitrage, and also the rational bounds that from Merton's work in 73 are sometimes checked. All of those happens to be a necessary condition, but they're not necessary and sufficient. So if you do that and you clean the price in some sense, and also the cleaning process is kind of not systematic in some studies, simply observation that seem to admit arbitrage are being thrown away rather than try to fit to find a set of prices that will be as close as possible. So by throwing things, you might be actually harming yourself as well for the estimation. So what we're going to do, or actually here there's a little bit more about what is done in the literature. In certain studies, you look at the observations from the market, you have put and call. So in certain studies, one moves to either working only with calls, which is the most popular way. Ours actually advocated the other. And the fact that one moves from puts to call is by the put-call parity. And that requires, obviously, knowing the interest rate that one will use in order to convert the price of a put to the price of a call. The literature kind of debates whether it is a good idea or not a good idea to actually introduce exogenously from the outside an interest rate, or actually just to work with the data without introducing any interest rate. So if you do convert it, obviously you have to have something about the interest rate to convert that. So this is done in Jacquarat and Rubinstein. The work of Atsehala and Durat, they simply just omitting the puts, they're using only calls. This is, by the way, the paper that I mentioned before. They clean the data in as close, like nearly satisfying the necessary and sufficient condition, they omit one condition that I'm going to point out when we get to that point. They do, however, introduce that later on when they try to fit a continuous function to go through the observation. So they find observation that discrete observation that might admit arbitrage, but when they try to fit to it a continuous function, as we're talking about here, the function of the price of a call as a function of the exercise price, they now at that point they introduce the constraint that they omitted before. So they do get eventually a price function that doesn't admit arbitrage, but it's not the one that actually passes through the discrete observation that are close as possible to the observed observation but do not admit arbitrage. And there's also been like an earlier work of Stutzer and Buchan and Kelly in which they basically what they do, they discretize the state space, or you know, with the underlying asset a priori could take any value between zero to infinity. They discretize it in some sense, and they write for each option or for each asset there the equation that its price is the expected value of the payoff, and they report that a system of equation that actually says that the price of asset is equal to its discounted expected value is consistent. Not only it's consistent because the discretization is done in such a way that the number of discrete points is larger than the number of traded assets, namely the number of variables is greater than the number of equations. They report that they have multiple solutions and they use different objective functions to pick one out of the multiplicity that both of them use here, some kind of a minimize a relative entropy or something along those lines. That kind of was puzzling to us at the beginning because we know that the observed prices do not satisfy the arbitrage condition, yet both of them don't mention anything about the prices admitting arbitrage or not admitting arbitrage. They don't mention anything about kind of cleaning the process. So we assume that they simply take the observation, discretize the state space, and find out that they have many solutions to this system of equations. So that basically what they do, instead of solving for the stochastic discount factor, which is a function, they move to a discrete probability, and they actually solve for the probability I for each realization. So in their case, the risk-neutral probability is a discrete random variable rather than a continuous random variable, like the risk-neutral probability. But yet the fact that they have a multiplicity of solutions, even if they only have one, implies that the arbitrage condition is satisfied, because we do know that the existence of a valuation operator is equivalent to the satisfaction of the arbitrage condition. So we kind of were puzzled, like, what's happening here? We know how to check if the prices satisfy the arbitrage condition. Our observation do not satisfy the arbitrage condition, yet here they find multiple solutions for the stochastic discount factor, though discrete, and this is the point. So how do we settle that? It turns out that when you move from discrete, from continuous to discrete, you have to discretize with care. If you don't discretize with care, you may find out that for your discretization, the observed prices indeed would satisfy the arbitrage condition in a discrete economy based on your discretization, but they do not satisfy the arbitrage condition in an economy where the state space is zero infinity. So we suspect that's what's happening here, and in fact, if they would proceed the way they proceeded, and they would have discretized correctly, as we'll see immediately what is the discretized correctly, they would not only they wouldn't have the problem of choosing one valuation operator out of the multiplicity, their system of equation would be inconsistent because the observed prices satisfy the no arbitrage condition, do not satisfy the no arbitrage condition. And once we clean the prices, we're going to move based on Atsehala and Al, we're going to estimate the convex function as a function of the exercise price, the put as an exercise, as a function of the exercise price, and then we're going to take advantage, as they did, of the result at Breeden and Litzenberger that connects the this function to the risk-neutral probability, and once you have the function, you actually have the risk-neutral probability or the stochastic discount factor either way. So we move now to the derivation of the no arbitrage condition. And we consider the following: an option market with European put and calls maturing at the same time, written on the same underlying asset, and a portfolio composed of the above securities and the underlying asset. Now, what we do here is really like we're approaching it from the very classical way of the definition of the no arbitrage condition. Firstly, I believe done by Ross maybe in 1976. And the idea is simply the following. Try to compose a portfolio with a non-negative cash flow for every realization of this, the underlying asset. And see if you and try to minimize the price of that portfolio. If you find out that you could get a portfolio like that, let's say with a payoff that is greater than or equal to zero and the cost is negative, then actually you have arbitrage. Or alternatively, if the cost is zero and the payoff is strictly positive for certain values of the underlying asset, then you have arbitrage. So what you're trying to do is to negate that statement. And the way we do it is that we formulate it by an optimization problem, again, in the classical way. But since here we're dealing with put and call, we're taking advantage of the fact that the payoff of a portfolio composed of put and calls and the underlying asset is going to be piecewise linear, because a portfolio is really like a linear combination of the asset in portfolio. So the payoff is going to be a linear combination of the payoff of each asset in the portfolio. The payoff of each asset is piecewise linear, and a linear combination of piecewise linear function is piecewise linear. So we're going to get, let's say, something like that, and immediately you see that if you require, and that we're going to put it in terms of a proposition, but it's very easy to prove, that if you require the value of the piecewise linear function to be greater than or equal to zero at each of the node points, and the node points must be exercise price of traded security, this is the only way to get the node point, and you also require that the slope from the right of the largest exercise price is greater than or equal to zero, that will guarantee you that the payoff is going to be greater than or equal to zero for every value of the underlying asset. So we're going to compose the portfolio like that and try to minimize the cost of that portfolio, and claim that the optimal value of that optimization problem must be zero, otherwise you would have arbitrage, and use the usual result, a dual primal, or if you want, theorem of alternatives, to show that we get in a dual kind of system of equation that speaks about the valuation operator. But what we have here, therefore, is a proposition simply saying, if you have H, a piecewise linear function, then if you require that the function is greater than or equal to zero, at each of the k1, k2, to kn, which are exercise price, then you get that h0 will be greater than or equal to zero. So that's basically what I just claimed using the graph. So that's what we actually do. This is the way we're going to guarantee the payoff to be greater than or equal to zero for every value of s. You see that we're taking advantage here of the fact that the function is piecewise linear, and therefore we actually have a constraint at zero and at each of the excise price, and something about the slope coming from the right. So you immediately see that the way, if you want to discretize, you at least have to include this point in the discretization, and you also have to impose something about the slope from the right, which is something that was missing from the Itzehala paper. Okay, thanks. Thank you. It's the fan of the overhead. Okay, so these are our notation. We have I, number of puts and call written on the same underlying asset, S, K1 to KJ, the set of distinct exercise price of the put and the call. Without loss of generality, we assume that we order them in this way. K1 is the smallest, KJ is the largest. And now we're going to define a matrix A, which is I plus 1 times J plus 2. I plus 1, remember, I is the number of contingent claim. It's I plus 1 because we also allow the underlying asset S to be included in the portfolio. So we have I plus 1 asset that we're dealing with. The column of the matrix is J plus 2. J is the number of exercise price, K1 to KJ, plus 1 because we also impose something at the origin at the 0, and plus another 1 because we're going to say something about the slope from coming from the right. So each of those columns is going to generate a constraint, and this is the way we define the AIJ. Again, it's the classical way. AIJ is the value of security I when the value of the underlying asset is K, KJ minus 1. I equal 1 here denotes the S. AIJ plus 2, this column is defined based on the slope from the right of the payoff of the security. That turns out to be a fairly simple matrix because this, first of all, about the slope, like this is the column for the slope. The slope is going to be 1 for a call. Remember, this is K, it's the slope at the maximum exercise price, KJ. So every call that is traded here has an exercise price that is less than or equal to KJ, and therefore it's already into that part of the graph, if you like, of the payoff. So the slope is, you measure the slope somewhere here, so it's going to be 1. The slope from each put is going to be 0, and the slope of the underlying asset is going to be 1. The value of the stock here, so for K equals 0, the stock is the underlying asset, which is really an index in our case, is obviously K1, K1, K2, K2, and here we have like a demonstration of a put with an exercise price K1, the values for call, and this is the type of the matrix. The structure of the matrix. Also, remember that the slope, again, the slope from the right is going to be a linear combination of the slopes of the actual payoff of the security in the portfolio. So the slope of the portfolio from the right is going to be greater than or equal to 0 if a linear combination of those slopes is going to be greater than or equal to 0. All in all, you see that in order to require that the value of the portfolio is greater than or equal to 0 at each of those points, and that the slope is greater than or equal to 0, that translated into that system of linear inequality where x denotes the vector of portfolio. So if x prime a is greater than or equal to 0, we do satisfy the fact, we do satisfy that the payoff is greater than or equal to 0 for every value of a. Okay, so bit by bit here, we define by P the price vector, and therefore the cost of the portfolio is X by P. This is like the usual notation, long long position is x greater than 0, xi greater than or equal to 0, or xi strictly greater than 0 means you have long position in the asset I, less than 0 short position. And the classical way, therefore, to kind of look for a portfolio for which the price is negative, the cost is negative, which means you have a cash inflow when you take the transaction, and the payoff is greater than or equal to 0, would be to try and solve that optimization problem. And if it's negative, then obviously you have an arbitrage portfolio, but if you require it to be equal to 0, then you actually negate an arbitrage condition. This is like, I'm kind of, there is something here about the strict inequality and greater than or equal to 0 that actually be easier to get not using duality in linear programming, but actually kind of what is a variant of Farkas lemma, that if you apply duality in linear programming, you would receive that if this is indeed the case here, note that this problem here, it's easy to see that the optimization problem here will either have value of 0 or it will be unbounded, because if you have here a value, say, some negative value, scale the x by any alpha greater than 0, and it will be unbounded. So if this is 0, this is bounded, and therefore by duality in linear programming you actually get that there exists a d such that ad equal to pd is greater than or equal to 0, but if you present it via Farkas lemma, or actually a variant of Farkas lemma, you can actually receive the strict inequality of d. It's all got to do with separation of sets, strict separation, and so on. So that's the way to prove those theorem of alternative when you speak about convex here linear or polyhedral sets. So the math behind it is really separation theorem. All in all, what you get is that if the arbitrage condition in the market is satisfied, then there exists that D such that AD is equal to P, D is strictly greater than 0, which is really the classical result that Ross gave in 1976. You know, our story is a little bit different, but the math behind is exactly the same. Garman actually in 1976 received a result similar to what we did here when he spoke about the put and call. He, however, introduced the risk-free asset. We did not introduce the risk-free asset here because we took the point in the literature, we favor the opinion that it will be advantageous not to introduce the risk-free asset from the outside. In a minute, I'm going to say something more about that. Obviously, if you would like to introduce the risk-free asset, there is no problem. You have another asset here, so you have another row in the matrix A, which is going to be very simple, and you solve and you get exactly the same way that you get here. So what we get here is that the existence of such a vector D that really is the valuation operator in that case. We'll see that the way this is being derived, there is some kind of economic intuition behind that, and it's a bit, I think, a cleaner derivation than Garman, and again, doesn't use the risk-free asset as it's used in Garman. So that D, so first of all, in a minute I'm going to speak about, now that we know that the arbitrage condition is satisfied in the real economy where the state space is zero infinity, if and only if this system of equation is satisfied, then obviously this is a finite system of equation, so actually moved from the infinite case to the finite case. That introduced in a minute, we'll see a very easy way of solving for set of prices that will be close to the observed prices if this system of equation is not satisfied. But before that, let me just say a few words about kind of the intuition for that D. This D, if you would have started from a discrete economy, then that D would really be what in economics literature is referred to as prices of elementary security or the error-Debye security. But here, obviously, we don't have elementary securities or those securities that pay a dollar if the underlying asset takes a certain value and zero otherwise. Here we actually cannot do that. We cannot spend such a claim that will give you a dollar if the value of on the underlying asset takes a specific value and zero otherwise. But with the put and the call, we can do something close to that, as close as we can in a certain way. This is actually also related to a work of Peter Carr and Bowie about static hedging of digital option. But the idea behind is simple. How would you estimate in this environment where there is security that you could use to form a portfolio to replicate a certain cash flow? You would like to replicate the cash flow of a dollar in certain state and zero otherwise, but you actually cannot do that because a payoff, let's say, that will give you a dollar here and zero otherwise, so the payoff function will be really just that and zero otherwise, is not even continuous. What you're working with is piecewise linear continuous function. What you could do is form linear combination of continuous piecewise linear function. There is no hope of getting a function that is not continuous. So this claim is not spanned by the primary securities in the market. However, so if you look at that and you say, I want to span that claim, but the only thing I can work with is put and call, what can I do? So what you could do is something that is referred to as the butterfly in payoff, and it's something like that. That you could do with the piecewise linear function of the put and the call. So kind of if you look at it from an intuition point of view, you would think now that the D's, that we got the existence of a D, then the D are really the prices of those cash flows. So if this is exercise price, say, K3, then D3 is going to be the price of that cash flow, and that cash flow is spanned by the primary securities in the market, so we can find its price. And what I mentioned before with respect to static hedging of a digital security, that a contingent claim that pays, say, dollar if the price of the underlying asset is above a certain value and zero otherwise, really the work, the intuition behind that work of Carr et al. Is that you don't want to really hedge it with the delta hedging because around that vicinity here, you're going to move back and forth. The delta is going to be very sensitive to changes in the prices of the underlying asset. So what you're trying to do is actually statically hedging that. And like if this is the closest exercise price from the left and this is from the right, then you could get this cash flow here and this cash flow here. And that obviously the price of the digital option is in between these two prices. So that's really what's going on behind there. And this is very similar kind of intuition here. And indeed, I'm going to kind of rush a little bit here. When you look at the system of equation, taking into account the structure of the matrix K, the matrix A that I presented before, you would find out the following. You could actually solve it analytically, that DJ plus 1 is going to be associated with CJ. CJ, remember, J, capital J, is the largest exercise, is the index of the largest exercise price. So KJ, DJ plus 1 here is going to be the price, and this is the largest exercise price of the call with this exercise price. Okay, now, sometimes it doesn't exist in the market, not necessarily you have, maybe it's a put, so you don't have a call. And since we don't introduce the risk-free asset, we cannot convert that to a call, but we'll see that you have kind of a shadow price of that, and indeed, once you clean the prices, there'll be multiplicity of these that will serve that, and if you look at it carefully, you could see that DJ plus 1, the multiplicity, any value that DJ plus 1 can take is in one-to-one correspondence to a risk-free asset that you can introduce to this economy by not violating the no arbitrage condition. And again, there'll be a few of those values. Each will be actually associated with a different value of the DJ plus one. And in general, we find out that indeed the prices here, assume that the distances between K1 and K2 and K2 and K3 are all equally spaced and delta K. So when you solve it, you find out that indeed the D's are prices of, if for the largest exercise price, it's the price of this call. For the smallest exercise price, the first D is the price of a put with that exercise price. And indeed, again, the same remark applies. Not necessarily you have a put with an exercise price here. And the other D's in the middle are really the prices of that type of cash flow. So those are the D's, and we now have a clear indication of whether or not the no arbitrage condition is satisfied in the market. We simply have to see if when we form this matrix A and we plug in here the observed prices, we try to solve that and we see if there is a solution. If there is a solution, the no arbitrage condition is satisfied by the observed prices. If there is no solution, the no arbitrage condition is not satisfied. Now, before moving into cleaning those prices, we actually wanted to give us a little bit of leeway in checking that, so we wanted to take advantage of the fact that our observation had bid and ask prices. So it's easy to see that the equivalent of what we have done, if you would allow bid and ask prices, excuse me, then the optimization problem for the no arbitrage condition will be this way, and you would require that the optimal value here will be zero for the no arbitrage condition to be satisfied. And then here, if you look at here intuitively, then you see what you get here is really you try to find the D such that AD, which is really kind of the your pricing of the contingent claim, is between the bid and the ask. In this case, obviously, you could see that this is saying exactly the same, that there are no arbitrage opportunities. So, if you would wondering whether or not the no arbitrage condition is satisfied in your set of observation, and if it doesn't, you would like to find a set of prices that will satisfy the no arbitrage condition, you could solve the following problem, where you try to minimize the sum of epsilon AI plus epsilon BI. See, this epsilon is really the AD should be between the PB and PA. So what you allow is a deviation here, subtracting some vector of epsilon B, and epsilon B is constrained to be greater than or equal to zero. And here, adding some leeway to that strip between the BB and the PB and the PA, you're allowing to increase it to the right, and you try to solve for a D that you put you in there, and you try to minimize the sum of those, the epsilon A plus epsilon B. Since epsilon A and epsilon B are positive, then minimizing the sum is really like minimizing the absolute deviation. So in a sense, we try to minimize a certain norm. You could actually go for the Euclidean norm. We simply wanted to stay with the real M of LP, and this way it allows us to solve the problem with the linear programming, which has an efficient and quick solution. So you have your observation, you form the matrix A, and you try to solve this LP. If the optimal value here is zero, then all the epsilons are zero, and you actually try to fit a D such that AD is between B and PB and PA. If the optimal value here is greater than zero, then you actually minimize the deviation from that strip, and the no arbitrage condition is not satisfied. But now you could instead use AD to generate a vector of prices that would satisfy the no arbitrage condition. And you actually, what you do here, you minimize the deviation from the strip. So you clean the prices by simply solving that problem and then declaring the vector of prices as AD. So So that's the cleaning the process. We're just going to show quickly some graphs here that you have like an observation. Here, the stars represent the epsilon, which is, in this case, we took PA plus PB divided by 2, and P hat, it's the AD, minus that. So this is the epsilon. If you have no deviation whatsoever, then obviously you sit on the zero. And here are some, just an illustration of what we received in certain cases. There is also another illustration here, but that's in the paper. I'm going to skip that to get to the next slide. So once we have these prices now that we know do not satisfy the arbitrage condition, we're going to try and fit a convex function that will go through the observation, and that will be our price function. So what we try to do is something the following, like let me put that slide here and it'll be clearer. Once we clean the prices, this is the case of a call prices. Once we clean the prices, we have the clean prices, and what we try to do now, because we know that the function of the value of the option as a function of the excess price is a convex function, what we try to do is simply to fit a convex function that will pass through that observation. Now again, it's kind of natural to think about the following. If you know that you want to fit a convex function, then maybe there is a functional space that you have like a basis that will guarantee you that every linear combination of the function in the basis is going to be a convex function. And indeed, there is such a result by Phillips and Taylor that says, given a convex function on 0, 1, then they come up with a basis that will span all convex function, obviously infinitely, and we're going to cut it at some finite point. But it seems natural that if you know that the result is going to be a convex function, and now you know that this observation, after you clean the prices, they do sit on a convex function, what you try to do is to estimate that by fitting a convex function in here, and that's actually what we do. Just as a note, because we clean the prices, we don't introduce a risk-free asset, but if we have a put and a call at the same exercise price, so implicit in that by the put-call parity, since we also have the price of the underlying asset, is a risk-free that is embedded in there. Because we clean the prices, then if there is another pair at a different exercise price, also of put and call, then there'll be also a risk-free asset embedded in that pair. But because we know that there are no arbitrage opportunities here, then the two risk-free assets embedded in these two put-call parity must be the same, because if they are not, then there is arbitrage opportunity simply by going long and short with the risk-free asset. So the way we work here is actually we use implicitly the risk-free asset that is implicit in those observations. If we have a pair of put and call, once we have a pair of put and call, then we actually have the risk-free asset in there. So we're going to call this function here that we try to fit or approximate H, and we know about H the following. We know that H is zero. This is the price of a call as a function of the exercise price. It should be zero. It should be S at zero. We know that it should be monotone decreasing. It should be greater than or equal to zero, or greater than zero at any point. So we're going to require that the first derivative of H at the point 1 is less than zero, and H of 1 we know is great. We're going to require that it's greater than zero. And therefore, with that, because we know that H is convex, because we use a basis of function that will always give us a convex function, these two, And these conditions here are going to guarantee us that H is indeed going to be monotone decreasing, positive at zero, actually S, and we're going to impose it to be greater than zero at one. Remember, one is simply what we're going to do is we're going to scale the observation that we have the exercise price because we're going to use the basis for 0, 1. So we choose some capital M which is kind of bigger or at least bigger than the largest exercise price, and we're going to scale everything by that M. So now we move to the space of 0, 1, and therefore we're going to use that Phillips and Taylor result, which says you have this total of the function in the space, in the basis, the phi n of the function in the basis. So we're going to require, we're going to solve now for the linear coefficient, depends how far you want to go to capital N, so that the value of the function coincides with the value of the clean observation, and those are the conditions that require here the monotonicity and the value of H at S. And the linear combination must be by non-negative linear combination. Again, it's that simple to see because we're trying to approximate a convex function. If you would allow here negative, you may get a concave function. So that's what we try to estimate. This is kind of a specification of the phis. That's the function, the basis, the phi zero should have the sign of phi zero. The phi one so is z times the sign of the first derivative, and the phi n let's see where I have that. This is the definition of the phi n, and that's the result of Phillips and Taylor. So what we're trying to do is to solve that system of equation here, where the phis are as specified in here, plus the constraint about the monotonicity, the value of the function, taking advantage of the convexity, we guarantee that it's greater than or equal to 0 on 0, 1 by constraining it at the both ends of the interval. And then what is left for us is to solve that system of equation. Once we solve for the alphas, we actually have an analytical expression of a smooth function of the call function, of the function of the price of the asset, the call in that case, as a function of the exercise price. I mentioned before that actually for us, it turns out that it will be more efficient to use the put function. And before going into that, let me just give you what's happening with our empirical results when we clean the prices. We're actually not going to, we are not implementing that, but we're actually solving for, instead of the function of the price of the call as a function of the exercise price, the function of the put. But this is just a snapshot of what we get as our empirical results with respect to the satisfaction of the no-arbitrage condition. We find that approximately 25% of the time, the NA conditions are violated when we look at a 1 minute interval. When we look at 10 minutes interval, we get about 55%. When the options are combined for the entire observation day, we never find that the no arbitrage condition is satisfied. We always have to clean the prices. That's when we do the study allowing the bid and ask prices. In many cases, you find in the literature that an approximation is done by taking the midpoint between the bid and ask and use that as a price factor, When we do that, we find out that the Norbert Rush condition is always not satisfied. Doesn't matter the length of the interval, it's not satisfied. So it's kind of fairly crucial to use bid and ask prices. Kind of running out of time here, so let me see if as I mentioned, what we do is for the put price function, but the idea is exactly the same. Again, we know that the second derivative of this function is the risk-neutral probability multiplied by the discount factor, or if you like, the stochastic discount factor. A second derivative of the price of the call with respect to the exercise price is equal to the second derivative of the price of the put with respect to the exercise price. So if we find out the price of a put, this function, which is also convex, but now it's monotone increasing rather than monotone decreasing, then we can actually estimate the P instead of the C, the call, the price of the call function. We're going to operate exactly the same way. We're going to kind of scale it, so we look at functions that are defined only on 0, 1. I'm going to kind of jump here quickly, but it turns out that those economical constraints that we require, like the value of the call, the value of the put at zero must be zero, like the equivalent of the value of a call at zero must be the value of the underlying asset, here are implemented given our approximation in such a way that they really like fix the coefficient of certain functions, and therefore you end up with an optimization problem that has less constraint than in the price or in the case of the price of a call, and it turns out to be more efficient and gives us better results. So I'm going to skip that and maybe just as illustration, this is what we're trying to fit now with respect to the put function. We use, again, this is a convex function, so we use the same basis, the result of Phillips and Taylor. The function is monotone increasing, should be zero in here and greater than zero throughout. It turns out to be easier to do from an optimization point of view. This is why we find that advantageous to work that way. One before last, we have to say something about our results are based on an option on the S&P 500, and obviously we have to adjust for dividend the price of the underlying asset. So what we used to do here, with the reservation, this method of course can only implement it on historical data, we have the dates, the value of the dividend, and what was the value of the underlying asset at the time the dividend was paid. So if you look closely what's happening here, that really is, if you take the current value of the underlying asset and multiply by that, that really tells you how much you need to invest in this, that security, so that at maturity time you have one unit of the security. So the idea is simply you get the dividend and you reinvested in the security, and therefore, when you have a contingent claim on the underlying asset, obviously, if the asset pays dividend, the price of the asset is not the present value of the value of the contingent, of the value of the underlying asset at the maturity, and really what you should use is the value of the present value of the value of the underlying asset at maturity, which is really kind of the portion of the value of the asset that doesn't include the value, the present value of the future dividend. And that's just an easy way of doing it. And we get that is the value that we use instead of the observed value of the underlying asset. Obviously, we take advantage of the fact that we know the timing of the dividend, the value of the dividend, and what's the value of the underlying asset at that time. So we know the fraction of the asset that you could buy with the dividend. when it comes, but obviously you cannot do that if you have, you're looking ahead with no historical data. Just to show you some of the curves that we got when we actually estimate the risk-neutral probability, something that really just resembles the log normal distribution. We did get some other, but many times there, that's what we got. And finally, we arrived to the conclusion. So what we did here, we developed from first principle necessary and sufficient condition for observation of prices of put and call to satisfy the arbitrage condition. That induces a robust methodology of actually cleaning the prices. We then kind of have a by-the-by report on the empirical satisfaction of the no-arbitrage condition vis-a-vis the interval time. And finally, we develop a new way of estimating the stochastic discount factor that takes advantage of a estimation of convex function. And the kind of advantage here that we have like an analytical solution, it's a smooth function. It's not like a piecewise or cubic spline estimation. You really have an analytical solution for the stochastic discount factor.